You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Lucinda Lonick. This is the WFHB Local News for Thursday, December 31st, 2020.
One party has to show that they have been damaged by the allegations they are making.
Coming up in today's program, the League of Women Voters delivers the latest installment of its podcast, Civic Conversations, in partnership with WFHB. That's coming up in today's feature reports.
It is a community that is really dedicated to making sure that its most vulnerable members don't fall through the cracks.
Also coming up in the next half hour, WFHB correspondent Catherine Patterson speaks to Katie Norris, Director of Hotels for Homeless, and Emily Pike, Director of New Hope for Families, in today's feature reports. But first, your local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Thursday, New Year's Eve. I'm Jake Jacobson. 6,543 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Wednesday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health. There were 99 newly reported deaths. Locally, Monroe County saw 63 new confirmed cases and reported one new COVID-19 death yesterday. Lawrence County reported 59 new positive cases yesterday, while Brown County reported no new cases. This morning, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb signed two executive orders that both deal with the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The first, Executive Order 20-52, extends Indiana's public health emergency an additional 30 days. The second, Order 20-53, does the same for the targeted restrictions imposed on Indiana counties based on their weekly county score, which can be found on the Indiana State Department of Health's website. The first Bloomington City Council constituent meeting will be taking place this Saturday, January 2nd. City Council member Sue Scambellari, who represents Bloomington's District 2, will be hosting an online Zoom meeting. This month's topics include the Unified Development Ordinance and the new zoning map, and the meeting will feature Bloomington's senior zoning planner, Eric Grulick. Residents are encouraged to attend this meeting with questions about the topic or about dealings in Bloomington in general. The constituent meeting will take place Saturday, starting at 1:30 p.m. More details on the meeting can be found at sueforcitycouncil.com. The City of Bloomington is officially accepting applications to sit on the newly formed Community Advisory on Public Safety, or CAPS, Commission. The CAPS Commission was established in November as part of the national conversation around police brutality and the safety of marginalized people in the United States. According to the city's website, the CAPS Commission will, quote, research evidence-based alternatives to traditional policing, identify best practices in public safety globally, and evaluate the efficacy of such practices for implementation in Bloomington, end quote. Community members interested in sitting on one of the 11 seats of the CAPS Commission can apply on the city's website at bloomington.in.gov/onboard/applicants/apply. That's all for your local news brief. From WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson. Have a safe and happy New Year's Eve.
The COVID-19 vaccination supply is limited, but updates on who is eligible to be vaccinated can be found on the state website, coronavirus.in.gov/vaccine. Monroe County Health Director Penny Caudill said local vaccine updates will be distributed through local press, the county website, county social media, and the county alert system.
To let people know what vaccine is available, for whom it's available, and how you can make those appointments. Scheduling the vaccine may change over the coming months, and so that will be something that we'll have to get out to individuals as well. So please be patient. Know that we will share information as we have it. Right now, we don't know who that next group specifically is going to be.
Caudill said the next demographic to receive the vaccine would be decided by the state. Brian Shockney, IU Bloomington Health South Central Region, stated the vaccines are safe and effective. As of December 30th, IU Health provided over 3,000 COVID-19 vaccines to frontline healthcare workers and recently received approximately 4,000 additional vaccines. Shockney also reported 5 deaths in Monroe County due to COVID-19 over the week of December 21st to December 25th. He mentioned the hospital has seen its highest inpatient rate over the last 2 weeks.
On the 26th was our highest inpatient rate. And I just want to remind people, when we look at these census numbers, this is the total number of patients that day with COVID in the hospital. And we have discharges. We can have up to 12 to 14, sometimes 18 discharges in a day. And to continue that increase, it means that there's more positive patients coming into the hospital than were discharged that day. That's how that continues to climb, which means it's continuing to spread, and we're continuing to see people sicker and sicker.
Caudill encouraged the community to safely celebrate the New Year's Eve holiday.
In the December edition of Civic Conversations, host Jim Allison speaks with Professor Sheila Kennedy, Spear at IUPUI and former executive director of the Indiana chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Today's topic of conversation is the Supreme Court. We turn to Jim Allison for more.
You're listening to Civic Conversations, a podcast collaboration between the League of Women Voters, Bloomington Monroe County, and WFHB. And I'm Jim Allison, your host. I'm very pleased to say that you can find Civic Conversations every month on WFHB at 93.1 and 98.1 FM. Today, we welcome Sheila Kennedy. Sheila is Professor of Law and Policy in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, SPIA, at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Thanks very much for being here today, Professor Kennedy.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit first about the Trump administration and SCOTUS. It's been quite a contentious election with multiple losing claims by the Trump administration. And recently, SCOTUS ruled on the Texas case where 18 states, including Indiana, signed on along with 126 members of the House GOP. SCOTUS rejected that case for lack of standing. What did you think about that?
Well, it was always going to reject that case, and it did lack standing. The Constitution requires that in order to have a case or controversy that is able to be adjudicated by a court, you have to have a genuine interest in the outcome of that case. In other words, one party has to show that they have been damaged by the allegations they are making. So in this case, because the Constitution gives each state the authority to manage its own election, it was never going to be a case that the court would take, because it is impossible to demonstrate, for example, that Indiana was harmed because Georgia allowed people to vote by mail. I mean, it was a ludicrous effort to begin with, and lawyers laughed. I mean, because as one said, it was really a press release with a filing fee.
A very good way to put it, I think. So you agree that that was correctly decided, I gather.
It was correct, and it was unanimous, I would
say. Yeah, unanimous, right. Let's talk a little bit about the Barrett confirmation and originalism. Last fall, Amy Coney Barrett sailed right through confirmation proceedings for a place on the Supreme Court. And during those confirmation hearings, she often said that she was an originalist. Can you explain what she meant by this?
Well, I think I know what she meant by it. I would take, I would say, I don't think she sailed through. It was a party line vote. But her version of originalism is, as she has said, the same one embraced or really invented by Justice Scalia, which asserts that in order to be consistent with the Constitution, you have to look at the world as it existed at the time the Constitution was drafted. That sort of rigid original intent simply doesn't work in real life, and Scalia himself simply ignored it when the case didn't allow him to pontificate about it. But I think a great example is a question I sometimes ask undergraduates. What do you think James Madison thought about porn on the internet? And typically the answer is a laugh. And well, I guess James Madison didn't think about porn on the internet. And he certainly did not. He could not have contemplated the internet. But what he did think about, and Jefferson and others thought about a lot, was keeping government from censoring communication between citizens. And so the kind of originalism that I think most real lawyers espouse is looking to see what is the value that the founders were trying to protect. In the First Amendment, they were trying to protect the state from being invaded by the church and the church being invaded by the state. And they were trying to protect the ability of an individual to form his or her own conclusions by accessing information, sharing positions, in other words, freedom of speech. And so when the court gets a case that involves the internet or something else, you look to see what sort of ruling will continue to protect that very important value. That is the kind of originalism that allows us to have what many call a living constitution.
I see. Let's dig a little bit deeper. Let me quote from your blog. You quote Chief Justice John Marshall as saying, quote, "We must never forget that it is a constitution we are expounding, a constitution meant to be adapted and endured for ages to come." So how would you say that Marshall's quote stands up to an originalist position like Barrett's? Hasn't Scott sort of, in a way, repeatedly rejected originalism?
You know, first, in order to reject something, you have to be able to identify and define it. And everybody has their own version of originalism. I've just shared mine. But the Chief Justice's comment, which has been echoed by many public administration scholars, is we have to run a constitution. We have to operationalize, I hate to use that term, but we have to operationalize it. So we have to make sure that the laws that we are trying to protect adapt to the time. Another great example, there was probably 10 years ago now, there was a new piece of technology that allowed police officers to stand across the street from a home and tell if you were growing pot in your basement. And the question was, for purposes of the Fourth Amendment, is that a search? Well, at the time the Constitution was drafted, the only way to conduct a search was through trespass on the property. Now, the court, I think, correctly said it is a search and it still requires a warrant. But those are the kinds of examples of why the sort of originalism that Barrett purports to hold is dumb. I'm sorry.
I see. Okay. Let me ask you this. How do you think most people view the Constitution? Do you think most people view the Constitution as Barrett does?
I don't think most people would know the Constitution if they fell over it. Certainly my students come to me from with an absolute innocence of civics. I had a student, an undergraduate student, that I asked that question to, what do you think James Madison thought about porn on the internet? And she looked at me and said, who's James Madison? And I did go home and drink. But the problem is there are every so often national surveys. The last time there was a national survey asking the population questions about the Constitution, 26% of Americans knew we had three branches of government. I mean, our civic intellect, our civic knowledge is so bad. I mean, if you go out on the street and ask people about freedom of speech, very few of them know that what the First Amendment prohibits is government censorship, not the refusal of Walmart to carry their favorite book or magazine. We are doing a terrible job of educating young people about the most basic elements of our constitutional system. And which is why, by the way, about 12 years ago, I started the Center for Civic Literacy at IUPUI, which is an effort to research how we might turn that situation around, what we actually know about the teaching of civics, and you know what kinds of tools we might engender to allow teachers to transmit really basic knowledge of our legal system.
Okay, well, after we've had that drink, what else could we do maybe to improve people's understanding of the document?
Well, one of the we need to really start supporting public education far more than we have been. But one of the things we need to do is get off this constant fad approach to what we teach our children. We need to reinvigorate civics education in the public schools. We need to, certainly we should teach STEM and we should test and do that. But we have gone, you know, there are too many people who think that the education system is simply to give kids tools to compete in a global economy. Well, it is, we do need to do that. I'm certainly not against that. But we, education and job training are not the same thing. And we need to prepare students to live in a multicultural democratic society. And you can't do that if you don't know what your elected officials are supposed to do or what rules they're supposed to obey. So I'm sorry, I get on a little bit of a soap opera thing on that.
Well, I'm old school too, so you're forgiven. Let's talk a little bit about religious freedom and liberty issues. Recently, the court granted an injunction which said that to limit attendance at religious services is to very likely violate the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. What do you think about this case and how it might impact public health?
Okay, first of all, I didn't read the factual background of the case. So here's the thing. If, in fact, a government official makes rules to protect the public health, which he or she definitely has the right to do, and then exempts religious institutions from the application of those rules, that's wrong. The government has no obligation to be nicer to religious organizations than anyone else. If, however, that case presented facts, which it may have, I do not know, that showed that special rules were being applied to religious organizations, then that response or that decision would be correct. So I can't speak to that particular decision. But in the United States, under the First Amendment, religious freedom does not mean that you have the freedom to use the law to make me behave the way your God says I should behave. What it means is that you are free to believe anything and in many cases free to observe, not all, as Scalia himself found in a very famous case back in the day. Laws of general application do not, religious belief does not exempt you from laws of general application. You know, we have laws against killing your kids, which I came very close in some cases. But at any rate, but you just because you believe that your God wants you to sacrifice your baby does not allow you to ignore that law of general application. So long as people are trying to keep us safe from a deadly disease by issuing rules that apply across the board, the government has every right and obligation to do that and needs to do that in order to save lives.
Well, let's bring this down to the gay marriage case. Recently, Thomas and Alito issued a statement on the gay marriage case that you called, quote, a profoundly damaging legal error, as religious freedom is not the right to impose some people's beliefs on other citizens. So where do you think the court is headed generally on religious freedom and liberty right now?
I'm worried, to be honest. When the people who were supportive of Barrett's confirmation made it very clear they were supportive because they considered her a religious zealot, for lack of a better term. I was encouraged by the fact that the court refused Indiana's request to overturn two lower court decisions that would have kept a lesbian couple who used artificial insemination from both being on the child's birth certificate as parents. And that, again, was a unanimous refusal. I don't expect that to last. I'm quite candidly very concerned about a court that seems to want to call religious privilege religious freedom, because the two are not the same thing.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about voting rights. SCOTUS has decimated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, of course. And given recent voter suppression efforts, where do you think we are right now in terms of voting rights?
Well, we're not in a good place. And part of that comes from the fact that we are now seeing, after 200 plus years under what is, I think, the oldest constitution in the world right now, that some of that constitution and some of the norms that have grown up around it are rusty, to put it mildly. We need to have, I believe, a national bureau, nonpartisan or bipartisan, however, to administer federal elections and make sure that everyone has not only the right to vote, but unlike today, where Indiana, for example, has the shortest day, poll opening in the country. We're, I think the other, there's one other state, and I think it's Kentucky, which is not surprising. You know, we need to have rules that the polls are open the same amount of time in each state, that the requirements for registration are the same. I personally favor vote by mail, as when you take a look at Oregon or Washington State, Colorado now, states that have gone entirely vote by mail have much better turnout, and people can cast more informed votes. They get their ballot. They can look to see what does candidate A believe, that sort of thing. But we definitely need to address a number of structural issues. The Electoral College, which nobody else in the world has an Electoral College. Winner-take-all rules in states to allocate those electoral votes. There, I have lists of things that we really need to address.
Well, let's see if we can bring Congress into this. You're right. States pretty much run elections the way they want to. But Article 1 does give Congress the power to override state legislatures in their conduct of elections for senators and representatives. Is this perhaps a likely way to achieve electoral reforms, the kind that you have in mind?
It would be, depending on who wins the elections.
Yeah.
I mean, Congress can do an enormous amount of good. But right now, we are in the United States, we are ruled by a minority. I mean, as populations have shifted, I think in the next few years, I've seen suggestions that, you know, every state gets two senators, but something like 18 senators will represent 70% of the population. And I mean, it's very disproportionate. When you add in the game playing that occurs in states where votes are suppressed and cities are particularly targeted, we are now ruled by a minority of the population, and that's just not healthy.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much. Thank you to the listening audience for listening to us on Civic Conversations. This is Jim Allison of the League of Women Voters, Bloomington, Monroe County. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan, grassroots, citizen-led organization that has fought since 1920 to improve our government and to engage all citizens in the decisions that impact their lives. I hope you listen to us in January 2021 to join us when we talk then about misinformation and disinformation with Professor Betsy Grabe of the Indiana University Media School.
Up next, WFHB correspondent Catherine Patterson reports on local resources for people experiencing homelessness. Patterson speaks with Director of New Hope for Families, Emily Pike, and Director of Hotels for Homelessness, Katie Norris. Catherine Patterson has more.
With the pandemic continuing to rage, this holiday season is unique. But one thing that remains consistent is the need for people experiencing homelessness in Bloomington to have food and shelter. Homeless shelters around Monroe County are doing their best to provide relief for individuals and families without means to adequate housing. However, this pandemic has created obstacles and more hoops to jump through than expected. Director of New Hope for Families, Emily Pike, says that the calls for shelters in Bloomington has gone up 30% since COVID-19.
This year, the demand has just been tremendous. The issue of homelessness can feel so overwhelming. It is a big problem. It is a systemic problem. It is not a problem that you or I are going to fix today. And understanding that can feel paralyzing.
New Hope for Families is an organization that provides shelter for those in need in the Bloomington and Monroe County area, typically in partnership with a local motel. They offer emergency shelter for up to 7 families at a time for those who do not have a safe place to sleep for the night. That number has not changed with the pandemic, but the precautions to protect those staying at this shelter has increased dramatically, with no cases of the coronavirus to show for it.
We have increased all of our sanitization procedures. All of our families are given extra cleaning supplies, extra masks. So people are asked to wear masks in the shared spaces. And people are asked to be very vigilant about their health.
While established homeless shelters are adapting to this unique situation, groups such as Hotels for Homeless have become a reality because of this pandemic. Director of Hotels for Homeless, Katie Norris, says the organization got its start from her own personal experience.
The way that this started was the first week of the shutdown. We had a family where there was a mother and a 2-year-old who were staying at a local shelter. There was 3 older children who were staying with other family members. And then the husband was staying with another family member and working. So when the husband would get paid, he would use his paycheck to rent a hotel room for a couple days and buy food for everybody. Everybody would stay together. And then once that paycheck would run out, because it would only last a few days, they would all have to separate. Well, the mother and the 2-year-old daughter, they called and asked me if they could stay at my house. And of course, I had to turn them away and say, I'm sorry, we're in the middle of a pandemic. I cannot expose my family. So I called every resource within 50 miles, and there was no place that could take them. So I got together with some other family members and decided that we needed to put them in a hotel room. Once they were in the hotel room, I reached out to Monroe County Mutual Aid, who was able to get volunteers and donations to provide them with, you know, things that they need. They basically were able to just isolate for 16 days. And at the end of that 16 days, they had saved up enough to put a down payment or deposit on an apartment. And they've been in that apartment ever since, all of them together safely. So then we just kind of went from there.
Leading up to Christmas Eve, Hotels for Homeless has housed over 120 people with similar stories, and now over 60 are living in stable housing of their own. Then, on Christmas Eve, they housed an additional 150 people in just that one night, with no known cases of COVID in the program yet. Although this organization came about for a world surrounded by this virus, Norris plans on continuing to allow Hotels for Homeless to grow post-COVID.
With our low-barrier housing-first method, it seems to be safer than the conventional or traditional congregate model of a shelter, and it allows people to maintain their dignity and stay with their families.
Community support is to thank for these heartwarming stories. Both Norris and Pike emphasize that although volunteering in person is not a possibility under current circumstances, both monetary and material donations are highly encouraged and are the reason that both Hotels for Homeless and New Hope for Families continue to help families in need. Pike says that although the vaccine is now being distributed, low-income families still have almost 18 months of severe economic struggle and continue to need help. However, she believes that the community of Monroe County can and will contribute to provide aid during this extremely difficult time.
We have not even begun to see the impact on homelessness. But the real silver lining in this pandemic has been watching and feeling how much this community cares And it is just so heartening. This is a community that really cares. It is a community that is really dedicated to making sure that its most vulnerable members don't fall through the cracks.
For WFHB, I'm Catherine Patterson.